From KCRW's independent producer project and the Believer magazine, this is The Organist. On today's episode, the philosopher Simon Critchley on his philosophy of pop music and memory. He spoke with our executive producer, Ross Simonini.
So I'm Simon Critchley, and I teach philosophy at the New School for Social Research. And I write too much.
Over two decades, Simon Critchley has written two large armfuls of books on death, politics, Hamlet, literature, pop culture. He's recently written a slim book about David Bowie and an autobiographical-seeming novel on the ancient technique of memory palace. While David Bowie and Renaissance mnemonics may seem unrelated, they're each an intimate part of Critchley's intellectual character. For this episode of The Organist, Critchley put together selections of some of his favorite pop music, which we'll be playing for the next 15 minutes or so. The track you're listening to now, for instance, is by the electronic duo Left Field. Critchley discusses how music functions like a Proustian cookie for our ears, how some melodies crawl into our heads and refuse to let us forget them, and how a record collection is like a memory palace, a tricky, esoteric concept that Critchley illustrates with glam, funk, slowcore, and krautrock.
You begin with the idea that memory is linked to place. In order to recall something, we have to recall the place where it was located. And that is something which was very common in antiquity, and then people cultivated their memories. And the idea of your internal memory was organized around a series of places that you could internally go and visit. So your actual memory was a kind of a theater that you could walk around and find things in certain places, locations, and what would be stuck in that place would be, I don't know, the various elements of logic or something like that. And you, by visiting that, by walking there in your head, you would recall the object and you could bring it to mind as you were speaking. So you've got that first idea of the internal memory, that memory is a kind of internal theater that we can visit. But then that was externalized, so the idea that the you could construct an actual theatre, an actual building, let's say a wooden building, with seats in different rows, and each of those seats would be a place which you would associate with whatever you want to associate it with. You know, it could be elements of learning, it could be personal reflections, it could be what you've gleaned from some important work or some scientific discovery. And then as you spoke, you would be able to recall that. So the idea, the memory theatre is a kind of, it's an attempt to make objective or thingly the internal kind of palace of memory. And it was also very often linked to kind of hermetic forms of wisdom, that if you could really, if your memory theatre as a kind of piece of technology really worked, you could recall the whole of everything, the entire sum of knowledge, at which point the distinction between you and God would disappear. You become kind of godlike through having a perfect memory. And that idea trickles down through the Renaissance and trickles down through the early modern period, and it's kind of with us in the kind of perverse form of the internet. Pop music has this, for me, relation to memory, to location, to place. You remember where you were when you heard it. You can, who you were with, what you were doing. You can assemble a life around these series of episodes. Memory is a kind of record collection, and a record collection is a kind of a memory. For people like me, the way in which the world opened up for the first time was really through pop music. And when you think back, when I think back to, you know, what you think of as a life, that life is something which is punctuated by a series of what I call episodic blips. And those episodic blips can be linked to specific musical experiences, songs. There's a view of who we are, which is quite popular. It's a belief that the President of the United States has, in the audacity of hope, that we have a kind of narrative identity, that we can put together a kind of an arc in terms of a story of our lives, right? And I think that's crap. I just don't think it's true. It's a kind of linear idea of time. It's an idea of narrative with the beginning, middle, and end. And this is a life has a purpose because it's heading towards a certain goal. For me, it's a kind of fundamentally Christian way of looking at things. And I think, you know, for someone like me, and I think for a lot of other people, identity is a kind of a series of episodes where you can think back to a whole bunch of episodes. And I think it was me back then, but not me in the way I'm me now. But some me, definitely someone with my name back then. And you can begin to not construct a narrative, not a seamless line, but a kind of constellation of points. And I think pop songs do that. And so that's why pop songs, one of the reasons why pop songs are so important. I mean, they're both relations to locality and location. So you remember, you know, I remember being in 1972. I talk about this in the Bowie book, hearing Suffragette City on my mother's mono record player in the so-called dining room in our house. Listening to Hallelujah by Can from Tego Mago in my friend Andrew's bedroom. His brother was at university and had brought back this album, and that was maybe the most important kind of musical experience I had, and that was about rhythm. There's a poem by John Donne called Song, which I can still remember because I heard it on a record. It's like, go and catch a falling star, get with child, a mandrake root, teach me where all past years are, or who cleft the devil's foot. Teach me to hear mermaids singing and to keep from envy's stinging and find what wind serves best an honest mind. I'm not even sure what that means, but I like the fact that I can remember it. And I think the poem's called Song. And I learned that by hearing it in the same way as you'd learn tunes by listening to them over and over again. And there's something about pop songs which is the fact that we know what they are. They're not strange. They're familiar, right? You can be 10 seconds into a track, you know, you're listening to a kind of a piece of Swedish synth pop, right? My current obsession is with a band called Kite. And a friend of mine from Stockholm sent it to me because he knows what I like. I put it on, I knew exactly what it was within 10 seconds, right? Here you're going to have. And the way Swedish voices sound in English, and the way they can do harmonies and all of that. But, so it's completely familiar, right? I know what I'm going to be listening to. But then that's twisted about 30, 40, 50 seconds in, because you realize they've done something with the verse structure and the way the chorus resolves you weren't quite expecting. And I think, you know, song does that, which is true of Swedish synth pop, it's true of American songbook, it's true of, you know, ancient poetry. We know the songs and we can sing along. There used to be a show in Britain, which is very, very influential for many, many years, called the Old Grey Whistle Test. And it's called the Old Grey Whistle Test because there used to be this, someone called an Old Grey, who'd be an old guy working at the BBC. And the test of a pop song was whether this old guy would whistle it after he'd heard it once or twice or once. And I think that's true. There is something, you know, the whistle ability of a song is really important. And I find the fact that pop songs are commercial, they play on the emotions, they're psychological, they're trashy, they're unforgivable, they're low culture. This is what I love about them, you know. And I can have very elevated views about the history of philosophy and, you know, kale salad or whatever, but I consciously retain my stupidity when it comes to music, and it's a sheer source of, you know, of seemingly, well, up till now, endless pleasure. There's a line of critique that we associate, I associate with the Frankfurt School and with Theodore Adorno, Teddy, as he was known to his friends, which would be everything becomes a jingle. That's the culture industry. And that's why Wagner is rubbish, because Wagner was basically banging out advertising jingles. You called them leitmotifs, but, you know, they were jingles, right? And that's why, and that's the psychological character of music. And I think that's just bonkers. I mean, it's, you know, and the kind of music which Adorno liked, I really can't listen to. Believe me, I've tried. I've really worked. I just don't get it. I want jingles. I want things that are going to get inside your head. So as I'm speaking to you, you know, I've got one song, maybe two songs, you know, kind of. I was listening to music today, kind of, you know, thumping through this great track by this band Poltergeist that had the guitarist from Echo and the Bunnymen. And it's just got a great kind of four note guitar hook. Nietzsche, you know, had this idea that music is linked to intoxication. And this word he uses in German is Rausch. And Rausch is linked etymologically to the word in English rush, which is not just the name of a questionable Canadian prog rock band with some strange political views. Rush, they used to be really popular. And it's the experience of what music does. Music kind of causes a kind of rush through your body. And I think that's interesting. It works at that deep, affective level and makes you kind of drunk. If I were looking for an immediate rush, I'd go straight for things like Chic and Patrice Russian. You know, so it would be funk. I mean that kind of, and that was for me, that the discovery of funk was just miraculous, that you could, you know, that music could do that all on one chord without anything having to change. But I always think that when I put music on, or when you find something, there is a kind of instant drunkenness that happens. You put something on that you like, or you find something that's really good, and at that point you're gone. It's great.
Simon Critchley's first novel, Memory Theater, is out now. Today's Organist was produced by Ross Simonini. The Organist is produced by Ross, along with me, a German CD single of Chris Isaak's Somebody's Crying that your stepdaughter purchased 45 minutes ago at a flea market in Berlin. Shelby Eladmani is our associate producer, and our interns are Zoe Kleinfeld, Zachary Kaibach, Claire Boyle, and Prashanth Ramakrishna. Thanks to Gary Scott, Nick White, Kat Yor, and Mario Diaz at KCRW, and to Andy Winnett and the people of McSweeney's and The Believer. We'll be taking a break over the holidays, and we'll return with a new episode January 7th. You can also check out an hour-long year-end Best of Organist special that'll be airing on KCRW and KCRW.com on New Year's Day. If you like the podcast, leave us a review on iTunes. Subscribe to our email newsletter or listen to all of our past shows at kcrw.com/theorganist. Thanks for listening.